We don't want to delay too long, and we also want to encourage timeliness for those of you who
do arrive on time, reward you for that. So next time, maybe we'll have less food so that only the people who get here at noon. No, I'm kidding. We love it. There's extras, and please feel free during the course of things to get up and get more, get desserts, and all that good stuff, okay? There's restrooms for those of you who are new, beyond the stairs, both upstairs and downstairs. My name is Eric Owens. I am the interim director of the Boise Center this year. It's a pleasure to have you here. We have a few handouts to let you know about our many events this fall, and we can you can grab some along the way or as you go. I'll just note that for all of our events, we have a rich set of rich package of content on our website as well: audio recordings, photographs, further materials to read if you're interested in this. After Lynn's talk today, we'll post a link to her website on this terrific project called Global Boston, right? And et cetera. So there's places on our website for you to learn more about each of the events that we're doing. You'll see that we have an event this evening, actually, called An Economy for the Common Good, A Theory of Change That Works. It's an Austrian economist or essayist and activist talking about the ways to restructure business and society to serve the people rather than the other way around. And next week we have, on Wednesday night, a major event for our students in particular. So I encourage you, most of your faculty, to spread the word about this. It's subtitled How Young People Engage Politics and the World in 2016. And it's meant to give a space for students to have a voice about all sorts of things, whether it's racial tensions or questions of justice or toxic political rhetoric or why none of the young people that we talk to seem to like the term millennials. And because they tend to think that us old people are blaming them for something, and we'll be talking about that. We always misspell it. We'll be talking about that as well. So please encourage your students, and obviously those of us who are beyond student age are welcome to come.
Is this something that's online that I could attach it to a link to a message to my students?
Absolutely, yes. Okay. Suzanne can forward that to you.
I will send it to you today, but it is also on the website if anybody.
It's on our website. There's links on our page, but we can send you a copy in particular.
Good, and I'll forward it right to my students.
That'd be great. Thank you. And finally, one of the other near-term big events that I want to mention is a major lecture on slavery and the making of American capitalism. The author is a well-known historian, Ed Baptist from Cornell. His book made a very big splash about 3 years ago when it came out, has some uncomfortable truths brought into clarity through detailed empirical research. And there's also some very important ideological upshots from this about what we think capitalism means in this country. So I hope you'll join us for that. Martin Summers of our AADS department will be responding to it. So we got this and many more. But you're not here for that today. You're here to hear Lynn Johnson. And before we get started, please flip off the ringers on your cell phone so we're not interrupted. And Suzanne, our program coordinator, will be introducing our speaker.
Well, we're delighted to have Marilyn Johnson here today. She's a professor, and as many of you know, a professor of history here at Boston College, where she teaches modern U.S. urban and social history. She received her Ph.D. in history at New York University and has taught at SMU, Southern Methodist University, and the Graduate Consortium on Women's Studies at MIT. Her research focuses on migration, urban social relations, and violence, and she has several books out, including The Second Gold Rush, Oakland and the East Bay in World War II, Street Justice, A History of Police Violence in New York City. Is that relevant at all today? Maybe you need to have other cities added, and you can make a set, right? And most recently, the reason we're here today is her book, which came out last year, The New Bostonians, How Immigrants Have Transformed the Metro Area since the 1960s. She continues to do research on this subject and is currently building this website that Eric mentioned, Global Boston, which she'll be showing to us in a few minutes. And it explores the immigration history in Greater Boston from the early 19th century to the present. So we're just delighted to have you. And let me get your PowerPoint up here.
Well, I'm really pleased to be here, and I'm feeling a little bit like yesterday's news because, in fact, this book came out almost just about a year ago now. It was timed to come out, if you want to actually just go right to the second slide.
Okay, absolutely.
It was time to coincide with the 50th anniversary of the 1965 Immigration Act, which in many ways marked a watershed in the history of immigration and is usually used as the starting point for talking about the new immigration, because it does change the flow of immigration into the country so much. It did that, as many of you know, by eliminating the old discriminatory quota system that had been put in place in the 1920s, and it replaced it with more uniform quotas that also had problems, but were not as blatantly discriminatory as the old ones, which were designed to keep those from Southern and Eastern Europe and other parts of the country out, and were much more generous toward those from Northern and Western Europe. So the 1965 Act, very briefly, gave had these new, more uniform quotas. It gave preferences, and expanded preferences, I should say, to skilled workers, educated skilled workers who were needed in the workforce. And it also provided exemptions for immediate family members became of citizens. So immigrants who came, who naturalized, became citizens, could more easily bring family members over, moving them to the top of the queue. All of these changes, they weren't really expected to bring about the tremendous amount of change that they did. In fact, most of the legislators at the time didn't think it was going to change things very much, other than letting in more of their own groups, which were, you know, typically Southern and Eastern Europeans. But it did. It had a tremendous change. And here in Boston, that change was staggering. In the 1960s, Boston was really a predominantly, you know, white Irish Catholic town for the most part, many other people too, but that was certainly the reputation. And now today, people of color make up the majority, in large part because of the recent history of immigration from Asia, Latin America, the Caribbean, and more recently Africa. So in some ways, this wasn't anything new. Boston has always been an immigrant portal. Even during those restriction years from the 1920s to the 1960s, Boston attracted a lot of refugee populations because we had such large numbers of immigrants in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, and those family connections continued to bring people here, whether it was Jews from Germany and other parts of Europe, Portuguese and others who already had were well represented here and continued to bring newcomers. But after the 1960s, we see Boston's, and I think actually before, even up to the 1960s, Boston was the number two portal in the United States for immigrants. And the East Boston Immigration Station saw more immigrants come in there than any place other than Ellis Island. I wanted to just start with a comparison. This is this is a chart in the book that just gives you a quick overview of some of the differences in the immigrant makeup between 1910, which was the peak of the old immigration, and 2010. And as you can see here, there were five groups that made up more than three-quarters of immigrants in 1910, all of them from Europe or Canada. And we flash forward 100 years, and we can see that there's a lot of groups, more than two dozen, that make up the same percentage. And most of them do not come from Europe being the green slices here. They come from Asia, from the Caribbean, China, Dominican Republic, and Haiti being the big three in the city of Boston, although, you know, Vietnam and El Salvador, Cape Verde, and Jamaica aren't far behind. But then, you know, we see people coming from all over the world, and the sheer diversity of the new immigration has been really striking. And it's not just ethnic diversity. It's diversity in terms of education and skill levels and sort of class identity. So we have, because of the skill preferences, We have many more highly skilled, highly educated immigrants coming in today compared to 1910 when the vast majority of newcomers were unskilled or semi-skilled laborers, factory workers, not many highly educated people coming in. So this tremendous diversity has really been a hallmark of that act. So now that the new immigration is 50 years old, it seemed to me, or I guess I started this when it was 40 years old, but it seemed to me that one thing that we didn't know that much about was what immigration looked like on the local level in cities in the United States. There were a few books that talked about the big immigrant portals, Los Angeles, New York, and Miami. Written by usually by social scientists, not much of a historical perspective, but many, now that immigrants are going to cities around the country, they're not just concentrated in the coastal areas, it seems to me it's time to start looking at what kind of impact immigration has had on particular places, and to do that from a historical perspective instead of just a snapshot of we read this a lot in terms of journalists and social scientists who are telling you about what's happening, you know, right now. Being 50 years old, this immigration has a history and it has changed over time, and it has been very much affected by the urban context in which it has occurred. So different cities have different immigration histories. So Boston seemed to be a really good place to do this. First, I happened to be here, right? So I didn't have to travel to do it. Second of all, you know, it has been such an important immigrant portal and continues to be one of the top 10 cities for immigrants among the largest cities in the U.S. and or is remain close to the top 10 anyway because it fluctuates a bit. And the other issue here was that the city has also experienced a dramatic economic and physical turnaround in those same 50 years. If you think about what Boston was like in the 1960s, it was kind of, you know, down at the heels, declining old manufacturing center, to what it is today, with this sort of the poster child for, you know, the new high-tech economy and knowledge economy. The question I posed in the book was, what do these two things have to do with each other, right? Is there any relationship here? And it seemed to me there must be. And what I argue in the book is that, in fact, new immigrants have played a big role in this transformation from the old Boston to the new Boston, but it hasn't been fully recognized, I think, by you know, society in general. Now, I don't want to oversimplify. There are a lot of things that have gone into the making of the new Boston, and we can think in terms of, you know, patterns of investment and high technology and defense spending and all kinds of things. But I think the labor piece of it and the demographic piece of it is really worth looking at, and has we just wouldn't have the city that we have, the metro area that we have, without this immigration experience. So I want to show you a few examples of that from the book. Just before I get to that, I just wanted to show you one of the other differences between the old and the new immigration. Now what you're seeing in 1970 is just the tail end of the old immigrant era. These are mostly older immigrant populations. But I think it's indicative in that it shows you the concentration of immigrants in the city of Boston and a few surrounding industrial suburbs. By the time you get to the 21st century, you see that immigrants have fanned out throughout the metro area, and in some cases some pretty suburbs that are pretty distant from downtown. The highest percentages of immigrants are actually not in the city of Boston. They're in a few places like Chelsea and Malden that are to the north of the city. And so we've seen different settlement patterns. And that's not to say there weren't immigrants in these communities earlier, but now there's a greater tendency for immigrants to move directly to suburbs and not necessarily stop in cities or have the second generation go out to the suburbs. There are a couple of reasons for that. One being that we have more highly educated, highly skilled immigrants who can afford to live in many suburbs. And then we also have lower paid, lower skilled immigrants who can't afford to live in Boston mm-hmm. anymore because of gentrification and the whole phenomenon of the new Boston and the impact that it's had on the urban economy.
What's that dark one to the south?
That is Randolph, yeah, mm-hmm. which is a place that I actually really would love to investigate further, which I didn't do for this book. I didn't want to neglect the suburban experience. I picked three suburbs to look at more closely to try and understand why immigrants were settling where they did in the suburbs. So I look at Quincy, Framingham, and Malden. Mm-hmm. And they all have certain things in common that attract. They all had older immigrant communities at one time. They all had an industrial base that essentially, you know, fizzled by the 1960s, 1970s. And it was those older areas that where housing costs were, where there were higher vacancy rates and housing costs were lower, that immigrants were drawn to. They also tended to have better transportation access. They had an infrastructure that could be cultural infrastructure, churches, certain parishes, and other organizations that were accommodating to immigrants. So there are a number of reasons for that. But I'm going to try and keep this short because I'm not already.
Don't stress. I've
been giving hour-long talks, and I got to get it down to 20 minutes. So let me just show you a few examples of what I think are the interesting impact of the new immigrant population in the city, just in terms of demographics and our population. If we look at the total population, the top line here, the top of the red, shows the pattern of population in Boston. You can see that it grew very rapidly from 1980 to 1930, and then it's kind of leveled out during and after World War II, and then beginning in 1950 has a very precipitous decline and doesn't start to rise again until the 1980s. It took a little while after the passage of the 1965 Act for immigration to reverse, to really sort of manifest themselves on the ground, and for those streams of immigration, the chain migration processes to take hold. So it's really in the 1980s that you start to see lots of discussion about immigration and research on it and reports. That's when it's really starting to have an impact. And very clearly, you can see that the native-born population continued to drop in those years until very recently, and it was the foreign-born population that brought the population modestly back up again. And honestly, just recently in 2010, we've seen the first increase in the native-born population if we factor in the children of the American-born children of those immigrants. That a bunch of that increase is accounted for by those children. So nearly all of the growth has been through immigration. And that is important for the labor force because the growth that we've seen in the labor force here in Boston has been, you know, really important to the new knowledge economy that we have, whether it's on the top end of the economy or bottom of the service sector. So you can see even more clearly here with the labor force that the native-born labor force has been pretty flat for the last 40 years or so, and it is really new workers who tend to be, and I should point out that Boston has an age profile, the native-born population, that skews old. It's one of the oldest populations. Yeah.
Can you actually get data on that third group, which is you have under native-born, but children of immigrants? I mean, first generation, that would be a neat third color.
Yeah, the census has collected that information in the past. They're not really doing it now. You would have to do IPIMS or something to try and pull that out. I'm not even sure if you could.
Because you're right, this really understates the impact.
Yeah, definitely. And particularly when you look at the public schools in Boston, for instance, the percentage of immigrants is much higher than in the city as a whole, so you can see that it's having a big impact on in the lower ages.
And this is people who are residents of Boston?
This is the city of Boston, because I wanted to get consistent data of the metro area changes.
Right, but people who work in the city? yeah. live mm-hmm. elsewhere would not be in this labor force. So, because the survey comes from households, probably.
Yes.
Yeah.
This is people who. No, this is people who live in the city
right.
of Boston.
That's right.
Yes. They may
so
work anywhere.
Who, right.
And probably a lot of them
and
do work in outside.
Who live
outside.
Out, who work
mm-hmm.
in. So, okay.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right. So, clearly, immigrants tend to be predominantly in the, you know, 20s and 30s, and their prime working age. And it seems pretty clear to me that without, you know, without the new immigration, we would not, and without these new workers who make up the lifeblood of the economy, it really wouldn't be possible to have a lot of the economic development that we've had here in recent years. One of the other things I talk about in the book is economic neighborhood and community revitalization that's occurred as a result of immigration. And this is something that's happened in city neighborhoods. Chinatown is one example, the Washington Street Corridor that was once the combat zone in the 1960s, and then primarily through Vietnamese refugees, many of them of Chinese descent, who couldn't afford to launch businesses in the heart of Chinatown, moved into some of these lower rent empty storefronts between the porn theaters in the combat district, and began to effect this turnaround in along Washington Street. And of course that revitalization process has been so successful now that, of course, gentrification has taken hold and has priced a lot of people out. So that's the kind of tipping point that we're looking at, and this is happening in a lot of neighborhoods. It's happening in East Boston right now. It has happened in Jamaica Plain and other places. So it's a delicate balance. I have many cases, both in the cities and the suburbs, people talking about, you know, boarded up storefronts as a lot of manufacturing industries closed down in industrial towns. You know, the downtown storefronts were boarded up, and things were, the white ethnic population was dropping. Along come new immigrant groups. They start small businesses. They, you know, they're contributing to the tax base. They're really helping to turn around a lot of communities. And I don't think we fully, you know, appreciated that. People in various cities are beginning to write about this. I have an essay coming out in a collection that looks at immigrant revitalization, urban revitalization, and immigration from the University of Pennsylvania. So I think there's more and more attention being paid to this now. And the rest of the book, I look at mainly at religion and politics, and showing how some of the same processes of new immigrants moving into some older religious and political institutions and transforming them in the process in various ways. So that's just a brief kind of overview of the book. I've presented, which I think is important in the current political climate, you know, a strong defense of immigration in the Boston area, and I think it's an easy one to make. It may not be so easy to make in other parts of the country, but I think it's pretty clear here what an important force in immigration has been, and how we really wouldn't have the same kind of, you know, new Boston without them. And I just think about my own experience. One of the great things about writing a book about what's going on in your own backyard is that, you know, your own experience, you sort of see it every day. And I just, you know, would pay attention to, like, what my day was like in terms of my contact with immigrants, you know, and from the, you know, the time I get up in the morning and until the time I get home at night, I am seeing foreign-born people, you know, all the time, whether it's my colleagues here at BC, whether it's the people who, you know, who mow the lawns and serve the food and take care of our children and our parents, virtually every part of my day, made it quite clear. And one of the funny things was that the cover of my book, it turns out that one of the nurse's aides who took care of my father in his assisted living was the daughter of this man in French. She happened to come to his room one day and saw the book and said, "It's my father!" So that just sort of drives home the point, you know, of how incredibly pervasive immigrants are in our economy, in our society. And but all is not rosy in this account. Obviously, there have been all kinds of problems and conflicts and dislocations and persistent discrimination and inequality. So I do have a chapter that talks about the history of nativism and racism, which has been particularly it has been, I would say, different in the current climate than it in the past 40 years than it was in some ways for earlier immigrants who were, with a few exceptions, you know, predominantly European. And even though they certainly experience nativism, we have patterns of racism and segregation that affect new immigrants regardless of, you know, where they come from, because it's just what they look like and what their assumed racial identity is. So I look, in particular, I explore what happened in the 1980s, which was really a kind of turning point in the city with immigration and the really violent, virulent reaction to Southeast Asian refugees who came in, who resettled here during that period. I also talk about, you know, the climate of growing repression and deportation that's been a feature of immigration, you know, nationally and also here in Boston since the night, particularly since the 1990s and especially after 9/11, and the way that how that helps to spawn an immigrant rights movement that is a sort of new feature of our political scene and particularly of immigrant politics. And then finally, I talk a little bit in the conclusion about one of the most important things in looking at this transformation is that I don't believe the fruits of the new Boston economy have been equally shared, that immigrants have helped to play a big role in helping to make this economy. And yes, there are those who are, you know, highly skilled, have well-paying jobs, live in the suburbs and have done well, but there are many, many others who continue to struggle. And part of it has to do with the success of the new economy that has created a whole set of problems here and nationally, whether it's gentrification, growing income inequality, patterns of contingent labor, entrenched forms of racism and segregation that have all made it more difficult for working class and poorer immigrants to make that move, the proverbial move up the occupational ladder. The lack of affordable housing and the growing cost of higher education is really, really critical. And I work mentoring immigrant students, and I can tell you, you know, some of them are really talented students and, you know, would love to go to a lot of different schools, but, you know, unless they're able to get, you know, fantastic financial aid, they're not going to be able to do that, and it's a struggle even to get through a lot of state schools given what the tuition requirements are now. And housing, likewise, mm-hmm. really difficult for a lot of immigrant families to live in some of these places like East Boston, which they helped to revitalize over the past 20 years, and the same thing in other parts of the city as well. So I will leave it at that, except to say that I'm not done with this topic. Usually after I work on a book for this many years, I'm ready to move on to something else, but I've really enjoyed working on this, and there were so many different immigrant groups and stories that couldn't be included in the book because I wanted to keep it under 250 pages, so it might get read in some classes. So I decided what I would do is to have create a website in which I could be more encyclopedic in terms of the different groups that I cover and the topics that I cover. So I have, let's see if I can get out of here and go to.
You can do a alt tab or escape.
Okay,
there you go.
Great.
And so if you go to Safari, it should be open.
Oh, wonderful. Yeah, there we go. So this was my project over the spring and summer. I started a website called Global Boston, and I'm really expanding my scope in this digital history project, in which I am looking not only at new immigrant groups in Boston, but also looking back in time to older immigrant groups, going back to starting with the Irish in the early 19th century, and trying to make a lot of those comparisons that people like to make between older immigrants and newer immigrants, but which are often simplistic. And to show the similarities where they exist, but also to highlight some of the differences in terms of the context and the different origins of these new groups and the cultural and economic conditions that they face. So right now, this is really just actually went online with this at the end of August, so it's only a very small beginning. But what I have are essentially three areas. One is which eras of migration, which is a kind of chronological overview of immigration history in Boston, and has a timeline and a number of different features. And then there's a section on ethnic groups, which profiles 16 different ethnic groups, which are significant in Boston history, 8 older groups, 8 newer groups, and a couple that are both old and new. And then the feature that I'm moving into now is something called Immigrant Places, which will look at the history of different immigrant neighborhoods in Boston, as well as some of the nearby towns and suburbs which have had a long history of immigrant settlement there as well. And the idea behind the site is to try and not only allow me to keep doing research and writing up some of this, but also to get my students involved in doing this research. I've had some in my bibliography, which I think was, I had a website for the book, and the bibliography was the thing that got the most use. And it's broken down into different groups, but you can see it's pretty extensive. There's a lot of people out there, whether they're faculty or graduate students or undergraduates, who the senior theses have been writing about immigrants here for a long time. So some of my own students had done some terrific work in some of my classes, and so their work is represented here, and I thought, why not get students involved with actually creating content for the website, as with they can. So I have, for instance, a senior thesis writer right now who's doing a slightly shorter thesis, who is also, when she's done with that, is going to write something on the history of Central American sanctuary movements here in the Boston area, which in Boston was one of the bigger sanctuary areas in the Northeast. So, and I hope to do more with both undergraduates and graduate students. Right now, I have a senior seminar on urban history that looks at immigration. And so we're doing a collaborative project on the immigrant history of East Boston, which is, as I see it, really on the cutting edge of a lot of things right now. And there's a lot of people in East Boston who are interested in this history. The old East Boston immigration station was torn down a few years back. They decided not to save it. So there are various groups that are trying to create museums or other centers there that would preserve East Boston's immigrant history. So this is an effort to contribute to that and you know, have the students learn about this history in the process and learn a little bit about how to create an ebook on Mediacron and using some of the tools of technical tools that we have here at BC. So it's exciting, and I would love to hear from you all. And just I'll keep that for the end. Joe.
So you mentioned the importance of that LBJ legislation. And am I right that what it did is it made higher proportion of immigrants get in because of their skill levels?
That was one of the things it did. First of all, it increased the total number of immigrants. It capped at a fairly low level. Yeah. It increased that ceiling. It got rid of the discriminatory quotas, which had much smaller quotas.
Country by country?
Right, yeah. Right. And mm-hmm. they were very unfairly set up. And yeah. Some could argue they're still unfairly set up because, you know, really big countries they're not done proportional to the country's population, but at least it wasn't overtly discriminatory as it had been before, and it made it possible for people from certain countries to at least have small quotas that they previously had.
So what proportion of immigrants now get in because of their skill levels as opposed to family connections or
yeah. That's a good question.
Including students? Maybe with the skill levels.
Well, students are not; they're coming in as student visas. So
I know, but they
right.
then get to
but
work.
They do. They transition, and that's very important in Boston because we have a lot of people who come as students, and then are able to get employers are able to get them visas to yeah. stay here. Sometimes they're, you know, they're temporary visas that then, you know, will translate into permanent ones. Yeah. But I don't know that. I think the numbers of it's somewhere between like 20 and maybe a third. At some point, there was some numbers, and I know it was higher in the Boston area than it is in the nation as a whole. I think it's, it might be around a third or something like that. Mm-hmm. But that's not. Don't hold me to that. This is just my memory from.
Yeah. That would fit with the national Maryland with two thirds of family preference, mm-hmm. one third non family preference, 10% humanitarian.
Ah, mm-hmm. okay, mm-hmm. great, yeah.
And I'm very interested in immigration and identity formation. As mm-hmm. you know, our colleague Kevin Kenny wrote about the folks from Ireland. Hi, hello.
He'll sneak in
how the Irish to become American had first to accept that they were Irish. And some people, you could write a book about the Italians much the same way for good reason. And the new immigrants are heterogeneous, really, mm-hmm. in many ways. I'm not sure how many of the Brazilians have yet come to think of themselves as Latin, mm-hmm. right? Rather than, say, Lusophone,
yeah.
and identifying with other Portuguese-speaking right. populations that are already
yeah, there's
in
a real
the
reluctance
area.
To take yeah. the Hispanic
and
label, sometimes maybe
I mean,
Latino.
Chinese and Vietnamese and Indians thinking of themselves with a common
Asian
yeah. identity, I think very unlikely. It may take some time. But on the other hand, I went to an Indian restaurant in Bedford a week ago, and most of the people in it appeared to be East Asian. So maybe there are things going on
yeah.
at levels in churches or in restaurants or in other situations
yeah.
in which people are working out how they can make their birth identities mesh with the strange categories of the United States.
Right. And I think this is particularly true in terms of the racial categories that we've had in this country,
yeah.
you know, since the middle of the 20th century. And I was just, I worked at Citizenship Day this past weekend, helping people fill out naturalization applications, which are, you know, pages and pages and pages long, and like, you know, I can't even figure them out, much less, you know, if you're coming in from the outside. I mean, they're really quite, it's a good thing that there's help for that, because
the census has about 25 Asian races.
Right. Well, in particular, though, they have a whole series of questions you have to answer. One is, which, you know, what is your race? And there are a certain set of answers. And,
yeah.
you know, they're not always good answers for people who don't see themselves necessarily as African-American or Latino. Or and they're much more likely to identify by ethnic group or mm-hmm. by, you know, region or, you know, so these categories and these labels don't always make sense for immigrants. They may make more sense for their children who
yes.
grow up here and are exposed to, you know, the racial regimes
mm-hmm.
that we
mm-hmm.
have
mm-hmm.
and I think tend to understand. And I've seen this with some of my African students here
mm-hmm.
who are I've had very interesting conversations with about, you know, what their parents' understanding is of,
yes, yes.
you know, who they are and where they fit in and what their experience is, you know, growing up in Boston or New York and
mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. and understanding the racial system here and trying to sort of negotiate between
mm-hmm.
the two.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's a very interesting question. It's one that's really affected politics in many ways because we have, you know, a political and urban political system from the 1960s and 70s that was very much set up around organized racial groups lobbying for more power, for more
mm-hmm.
funds,
mm-hmm.
for
mm-hmm.
and that was I argue that was really the beginning of the new immigrant politics here. But you
mm-hmm.
kind of had to slot yourself. You had to ally with a certain racial group of usually native-born people who were already here and already organizing during
mm-hmm.
the 1960s. You know, street-level sort of protest politics. But as more and more new immigrants have come of age and second generation, They have kind of redefined that politics, and now we have something that's much more sensitive to immigrant rights issues and you know, transnational issues and some of these issues of identity and you know, fighting for not for, to get the census changed so you don't have to check certain boxes if that's not what you believe yourself to be.
Without breaking confidentiality, could you say which way the children of African immigrants are moving? I mean, is it to identify as African American? Most of the ones I know identify with the country they came from in Africa, and so that doesn't or just people of color or something like
that?
Yeah,
no, I think they're much more sympathetic to, they, especially with the Black Lives Matter movement, I think there's been a much bigger a tendency to relate to that and understand where that's coming from, particularly if, you know, they've grown up in these, in this racial world and have been subjected to it. It doesn't matter who they are, you're still treated on the street like, you know, the way the police might approach you may not matter if you're, you know, your parents are professionals from Nigeria or whatever. Right? Yeah. Yes.
Thank you, Professor. I have a question that about how the Obama administration, the congressional elections in 2012 and also, was it 2014, have impacted immigrant communities in Boston. So, for example, like the aspiration around the DREAM Act, as well as prompts for immigration reform. I'm curious as to how, and if you can comment on how Boston immigrant populations have reacted to that. The only reason why I ask is because I had believed that it was, you know, almost uniformly assumed almost that immigrant populations may align, really those coming from accepting a person of color background as some part of what maybe perhaps Latino or Hispanic identity would associate positive affect with the Obama administration. However, I also have learned that that's not the case because of the inability to pass a lot of the reform that has been sought. So I'm curious as to how, if any of your research has borne out or you can comment on how Boston immigrants have reacted to our political climate in the last 4 years.
Yeah, that's a really good question. I the way I approach politics in the chapter, and this was really just an initial attempt into to approach this subject, I look basically at local politics and immigrants getting representation or immigrant communities getting representation in the system locally and to some extent at the state level. I didn't really look at national politics and the impact that had. That said, I think there are certain issues and certain elections which have dramatically increased both, you know, naturalization and people registering, immigrants registering to vote and wanting to participate in the system, and that would go for the children of immigrants as well. Whether that lasts is, you know, a big question. There's just an article in the New York Times Magazine this weekend about, you know, that perennial effort to try and, you know, boost the Latino vote, and how there was a lot of high hopes for that this election because of Trump and Latinos being, and immigrants in general being so, you know, opposed to him and wanting to vote. But I guess past episodes of when we've had, whether it was Obama's election or whether it was Proposition 187 in California, which was the big anti-immigrant proposition there back in the 1990s, it has a temporary effect of, you know, increasing the vote, but it doesn't seem to continue have holding power into the future. So there's sort of an oscillations depending on what's going on at the time, and I think that may be the case with Obama, and now with Clinton doesn't seem to have inspired a lot of younger people of color to want to go out and vote, but maybe the threat of Trump will. I don't know. We'll see.
Thank you.
Yes.
I have a question about Randolph.
Yeah.
What more can you tell us about that? What groups migrated there and why?
There's a lot of Haitians.
Oh, okay.
There are a lot of Vietnamese, a good number of Cape Verdeans. It's pretty diverse. I mean, I think it has a reputation for being a place where Haitians and other African West Indian immigrants who lived in the Dorchester, Mattapan area, sort of a spillover into the southern suburbs. I think there's a whole arc of settlement between the sort of Dorchester, Mattapan area all the way down to Brockton, which has seen, because of the high cost of living in Boston and people needing to move out of the city, and particularly to Brockton, which was more affordable. And Brockton has a very large both Haitian and Cape Verdean population. And some of that also is Cape Verdeans moving up from southeastern Massachusetts, which is where their historical areas of settlement were going back to the 19th century. And I think Randolph is part of that. But there's a much more complicated story there that I don't fully understand, and that's one of the things I want to do with the website. Mm-hmm. Randolph, I decided not to, originally thought Randolph might be one of the towns I would write about, but there's almost no historical, published historical work. Usually there are local historical societies that have material that you can sort of start with, and I didn't have the ability to really go in and dig everything up from, you know, from square one. So yeah. I ended up not doing Randolph, but I do want to do it in the future.
Yes.
In a place like Randolph, do these various groups mix much, or do they have their own little sub-neighborhoods and grocery stores and churches?
I think they do. Well, I don't know about Randolph in particular, but
in Boston,
certainly in Malden, there seems to be a good degree of mixing. And I think in Quincy and Framingham, you have sort of really dominant ethnic groups there. In Quincy, obviously, Chinese and to a lesser extent Vietnamese, and have been heavily concentrated in North Quincy, and particularly, you know, the whole commercial area there is, you know, you feel like you're in Chinatown, only bigger, you know. And in Framingham, of course, Brazilians have been very dominant in the downtown area. But there are other groups there, and I do think there are not separate, you know, there is a Brazilian enclave, but there are other groups that are there as well. And even in the downtown area, there are storefronts that are owned by other groups. So I think there is probably a greater degree of mixing than in some of the urban neighborhoods.
Several decades ago, I spent much time in Milford, which was half Irish, half Italian.
Mm-hmm.
Railroad tracks down the middle. Each had their own churches, each had their own cemeteries. And if you went there, the sad thing was they were both on the wrong side of the track.
Right.
But obviously they mixed in public schools and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
In the elementary school, you know, the Catholic elementary schools, it was just a remarkable
decision. Yeah, well, it's interesting in Framingham, not far away, you have, it's the downtown area where first Latinos and later Brazilians are settling, and a lot of it had to do with, that was the industrial end of town, and there was a GM plant, and there was, you know, all kinds of large industries there that slowly shut down between the 50s and the 70s. But there were also churches there that became the center of immigrant communities, and St. Tarsicius, which was the Italian parish, and was founded really to serve Italian immigrants, later was taken over became a Portuguese parish, mm-hmm. and then eventually becomes a Brazilian parish. And mm-hmm. obviously, a lot of places Brazilians settled have been places where there were Portuguese populations before, mm-hmm. and initially there were fairly, you know, welcoming relations, although it wasn't always the case later on. They went their separate ways in some cases.
A friend of mine who taught at BU taught a lot of master's students in economics, and they were almost all from other countries. I mean, mm-hmm. he pays their electric bills with it. And so he used to hand out a little questionnaire at the beginning just to get to know his students' name, and did your parents go to college, and things mm-hmm. like that. And then to find out where they were, he would have city, country. And one kid just circled country. I'm from the country, not from the city.
So some of the towns that you speak of have some very low economic income areas. So mm-hmm. I'm wondering if your research shows economic success for the immigrant population you've been studying.
Well, I talk, this is issues that I talk about mainly in the settlement chapter, and I've tried to outline this, particularly in terms of the suburbs, which is where you see, you know, perhaps the most dramatic array of. So you have certain suburbs that highly skilled, highly educated immigrants are going to. They tend to be out along the 128 corridor, and they tend to be people who work in the tech and medical industries and who want to live close to work. That's the one case where people are able to live like the old immigrants, where you know you lived in South Boston because you worked down on the docks and you could walk to work. So the people out in those suburbs often live in those places because they work nearby. They have good schools. They're interested in good public education for their children. So you see towns like you know Lexington, Burlington, a few others you could mention to the north of there. And then on the other end of the scale, you have places like Chelsea and Lynn, right, which are, you know, old industrial cities that have gone through a lot of hard times and lost a lot of their industry and now have old immigrant housing that is filled up with new immigrants and refugees who tend to work, you know, they might work in Boston, they might work out in suburban malls or as, you know, in building cleaning services or cafeteria workers, whatever, but they tend not to live close to their workplaces. They tend to have to travel and they often need cars to get there, which is one of the reasons why driver's license for immigrants is such a hot issue, right? Because for many immigrants, it's a life and death issue. They can't get to these low-paid service jobs that are spread out across suburbia without automobiles. So, you know, there are a lot of, and of course, those same communities are the ones that have, you know, the worst kind of urban crisis that have gone on in their schools and infrastructure, and they become kind of warehouses for poor immigrants who you know live there because that's where they can afford to live, and then eventually, and of course, vibrant immigrant communities have emerged there too. So they are places that are valued in many ways, and some of the mill towns even further out. Places like Lawrence, you know, that have close to 80% Latino, you know, population. That's quite remarkable. You know, a lot of the reason people went there, particularly Dominicans, as well as, you know, Puerto Ricans and some other groups, is because they wanted to buy homes and they couldn't afford to buy condos in Boston or New York or wherever they were coming from. And so that was a big attraction, and also to get away from some of the urban problems in some of the more congested immigrant neighborhoods in Boston and New York. It was the idea that you could go there and buy a home and live in a tighter community among, you know, fellow, you know, countrymen. So, and then there are towns in between, which I refer to, borrowing from another scholar's term, one-step-up communities, and that's where I would position Quincy and Malden and Framingham. These are towns they're towns that are doing pretty well economically, that have pretty strong economies, but they have these older areas that were deindustrialized, and they become centers of new immigrant communities that then expand. And in the case of Malden and Quincy, they also have the Orange Line, which makes it easy to commute to, and which was a big attraction for Chinese immigrants in particular, who were commuting to Chinatown to work in restaurants and to work in the garment industry and other employment centers. So all of that's been, I would argue that immigrants were a particular blessing sort of for those communities, because their interests, the immigrants' interests and the town interests or the city interests meshed very well, and the revitalization effort, you know, came about through the efforts of both. There are many, many other suburbs that, you know, through various, you know, zoning laws and other, you know, failure to build apartment housing or public housing have not been very it's not possible for a lot of lower-income immigrants to live there, right? And I think certain kinds of, I found that places that had a history of building a lot of multifamily housing and public housing, subsidized housing, these are the places that where immigrants have gone to because they've had affordable places to live.
Thank you.
Am I right that there is an Office of New Bostonians? I think
there
I've
is,
seen
except it is now called the Office of Immigrant Mayor's Office of Immigrant Advancement.
Okay.
It got renamed under Marty. Yeah.
Okay. Well, I was curious what they, how you would evaluate their success, what their mission is, how broad their mission is, how successful they've been, and whether their way of approaching things aligns with the way you would think it should be approached, whether it's purely economic or whether it's cultural or whether it's with regard to other issues that you cover in your book.
Well, I think actually I do talk about it in the book, and I think it's significant in part because historically because it was one of the, Boston was one of the first cities to have such an office. Mm-hmm. There were a few cities that had immigrant liaisons, but this was one of the first attempts to have, you know, a full-scale office with multiple staff working on this issue. And I think they became a model for other cities. And now it's quite common. There are, you know, several dozen cities, I think, that have these kinds of programs. And that's because they've been successful. They provide information in multiple languages to newcomers who are trying to access city services and deal with schools and deal with all kinds of things that are perplexing even for many of us who lived here for many years, right?
Yeah.
And we're born here, maybe. So that I think that has been an important function. I think they've been important for just our general understanding of the role that immigrants play. I mean, I draw myself on a lot of the data that they've produced, and they work with the BRA to create a lot of data that shows just how important immigrants' contributions are and where we need to sort of do better to accommodate them. They have, you know, they've had a number of other initiatives with, now they're working with the Citizenship Day thing that I talked about is something that the Office of Immigrant Advancement was very involved with. There were efforts to do that back during the Menino administration, but it ran afoul of some political problems. But now I think they're partnering with a nonprofit that is working citizenship and, you know, fostering citizenship and getting better access to English language classes. The English for New Bostonians program that they started years ago, mm-hmm. I think has been important and has helped to shorten some of these, in some cases, very long lines that people have to wait on to get into English classes.
There's a group called something like Welcoming Boston. Does that ring a bell?
They co-hosted Saturday's event.
Ah, okay. And what
is that part
based?
Of the government?
No, it's part of a national movement called Welcoming America.
Yeah.
And it's, Marty signed on right away to be a welcoming city, so he was an early mover, one of the first 12. But it's a good national movement that's like No Place for Hate, the sort of anti-discrimination movements of the past against anti-Semitism or against racial bias, and it's been well received.
Mm-hmm.
It's across the country.
Ken?
Thanks, Glenn. That was great. I have just a quick footnote to David's comment and a question. As it happens, I was reading this morning about a census category, Native American Mexican. And I believe in the last census, 125,000 people saw identified. It wasn't clear if they were immigrants or if they were born in the United States, but that was the identification they chose. Now, that may be a footnote to David's commentary. It may actually be something that is here in Boston and that complicates dynamics within communities, but it was just extraordinary to read about it. The question picks up on the previous question about the economics of the new communities. And if you think about it, we have a received narrative on American immigration history that begins with some form of uprooting and transition and ends in assimilation. And it was laid down in the middle of the 20th century. Mm-hmm. It was actually written down by the sons of the new immigrants, by Oscar Handlin and others. It's a narrative that has some merit. In fact, it works best after immigration exclusion, when those who are immigrants and their descendants start to do well by measures that have to do with social mobility, education, income, that sort of thing. What strikes me is that the period in which that narrative has been laid down, and it is our narrative today, we're also being told these days is a period of aberration in American history and indeed in European history when inequality was diminishing rather than rising.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
mm-hmm.
I'm sure there's plenty of debate on that. But what I wonder about today is when we hear so much about inequality rising, what story we can tell about immigration. Because I taught a class this summer in which half the students were of the new immigrant kind that you're describing,
mm.
and they just couldn't see in their lives and in their family lives the histories we were reading about earlier periods. And I just wonder, is there...
you mean they couldn't see the assimilation story?
Yeah, they couldn't mm-hmm. see that happening in their lives and in their family's lives. Mm-hmm. They were so skeptical about that. It was so... what I've described as the received narrative made
mm-hmm.
so little sense to them on
mm-hmm.
a day-to-day life. And I just wonder if the received narrative is predicated on this aberrant period of diminishing inequality, and if we now have one. I don't know. I'm saying this with Bob and Joe here deliberately. But it strikes me, when I look at the big narratives, is there a connection between... rising or diminishing inequality and how we're going to characterize immigration. And certainly in my students' minds there was.
Yeah.
They weren't seeing in their prospects what we were studying in the past.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, can I
follow on that? Because I'm curious, just anecdotally, I have friends from immigrants from Ghana, and they were very concerned that their child that was born in the U.S. not speak their native language of Away, but only speak English. They didn't want him. And I said, look, I'm not an immigrant, but I feel that you should teach your own language because you're much more jeopardy of losing that than your child. Not. So I wonder in terms of assimilation, I mean, certainly how language functions and how the big picture is reflected in the assimilation of the use of English and changing nature of English.
Certainly the Nigerians are not losing their native language. No, and all the Nigerians I know, and I know quite a few, are
mm-hmm.
you know, raising their children to be bilingual.
Mm-hmm.
English is extremely important because
yeah.
that's the outside the home language, but the home language will be the language of the ancestors.
Right.
We talked a bit about language, but what I was hearing from them is from the young people is we're not going to do better than our parents.
But they're getting that from the larger culture.
That's right.
All young people are saying,
that is broader, right?
Yeah.
That set of this generation.
Yeah.
But it does sort of undermine the cherished narrative, and that narrative
right.
that I teach, well, I don't teach it, I'm critical of that narrative too,
mm-hmm.
but it makes less sense to them.
Well, I think you're right that assimilation may be a product of that particular time period and experience of the restriction era, right? As you say, without immigration restriction and you know, having a period of stability and Americanization that goes on
mm-hmm.
across
mm-hmm.
ethnic groups, and particularly through the labor movement and the welfare state, it's hard to imagine having that particular convergence of things anytime soon, so I can see why your students might be skeptical.
Or is it just long-term and short-term perspective?
I don't know. I mean, I think
we tend to condense a lot
mm-hmm.
in the past into a common narrative, when in fact it was a very lumpy process.
Yeah, but I think the whole notion of assimilation is just really dated, right? I know
nobody's
talking, and it's not surprising that they would not relate to that, right?
Yeah, and it didn't work for the earlier period
right.
either.
That's exactly.
One of the things we teach them. But what I'm wondering is if the story was laid down in a period economically that seems to have been quite unusual,
mm-hmm.
and we're now in such a radically or a very different economic period. There's a big if there.
Yeah.
But then what's the narrative? Right? It's a big question, I know.
But the
challenge of your work, when I see. For me, because I work on the 19th century and the early 20th century, is I keep asking myself, how is this story different? It has to be different, right? It can't be the same story.
Mm-hmm.
And then the story that historians told, the dominant narrative and the narrative that became part of popular culture, if it was laid down between 1930 and 1970, that's an interesting time for that story to have been told, in terms of the economic context after the Depression.
Yeah. But I think we need to think about who the immigrants are as well, in terms of, you know, they're so much more diverse in terms of their their economic status and skills, and as well as their, you know, ethnic and racial backgrounds. That it may, assimilation as a narrative may have worked better when you had a predominantly unskilled, you know, working class, mostly European, white European population in an industrial society that had labor shortages, and, you know, there was sort of nowhere to go but up, right? But
it's much more complicated. It's made up of the narrative today, but it's hard not to think in terms of its opposites, right? You can think in terms of poverty, inequality, alienation, and so on. I think that they're the opposite of something. But what's that something? I don't know.
Why don't you use your hand?
Talking across the room, but I thought one of the things I'm thinking, I don't know how much a good study for Boston would be true, even Lexington with 25% foreign born. You know, you get a very different narrative in the suburbs, where there's no indication of sociological separation or of enclaves or of any kind of distinctions being made. Yeah. It's quite a social phenomenon to look at that versus to look at East Boston or to look at the phenomenon of even South Boston or the Jamaicans of Roxbury. So I speak in the language of multiculturalism, Canadian model, but more of integration, because that is a different narrative. The narrative is an operational, functional basis of participation in the norms, but not necessarily a simulation of a common identity. And it's a very different, I think there is another narrative out there. The international conferences are using a different vocabulary. Assimilation is a 20-year-old term dead for a couple decades. So the question is, what is there? Those are the two dominant vocabularies. But
I don't think U.S. historians have used it since the 1960s.
Bob, why don't you jump in, and then we'll wrap up.
To the extent that, you know, we've seen increased returns to skill, you know, that's been a big phenomenon over the last 40 years. The shift toward, maybe I don't think this is what's driving inequality, but it moves in the same direction to the extent that you're letting in at least a portion of your immigrants as having higher skill levels, and then the rest are family connections, which again might mean lower skill. Maybe the skill dispersion of the immigrants that are coming in today is broader, as you know, than in the past.
Yeah.
So the return to skill, which has gone up, then exacerbates the impact, and that might then lead to a widening of income inequality. I don't think that's the major force here. I think it's a broader set of forces. Mm-hmm. But that would be consistent with then this situation today, where even people who may be immigrants from families that had some skill when they immigrated would be fearful that, you know, in this environment, as I think all students today are, that, you know, are not going to be as well off as their parents. So, but that could be a dynamic that's playing out, but I think it would be a secondary dynamic to the broader forces.
Well, I know lots of you have to get to class or get to work or do whatever you do when you're a retired professor and it's just eat grapes all day, right?
I have three books to write.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you all for being here.
Can I say one last thing? Yeah. I just want to make a pitch to those of you who, you know, teach about immigration or have students who are interested in this. I'm really interested in connecting with students who want to work on these kinds of issues, and particularly if they're willing to do historical work. I'd like to make contact with other professors who work on immigration and get them to be involved in you know, helping me, to advise me on the site, make contact with people who would be good oral history informants, which is a big part of what I want to do in the future. So just a pitch for those people out there, if you know people who do this kind of work, I would love to talk more to other folks on campus about this.
Well, thank you so much for being here. And if you haven't already eaten all our desserts, please do so I don't have to sneak down there today.